I'm afraid I need to talk about money. For a Brit of a certain age, that's not an altogether comfortable prospect. Sorry. We're not good on money. It's almost a taboo subject. The weather's easier. And yet it has to be done. One wag has written, "Money isn't the most important thing in life, but it's reasonably close to oxygen in the got-to-have-it stakes." Two men are talking. One says, "Money isn't everything." The other, "Who told you that?" "My boss." There's perhaps a bit of the Spike Milligan in most of us. All I ask is the chance to prove that money can't make me happy. Well, the only comfort for the preacher on this topic is the utter realism of the New Testament on the theme. Jesus gave it more time than any other subject except the kingdom of God. More time than power or sex. Of 38 parables, about 16 touch on money. He gives it startling attention. It matters profoundly to who we are, how we live. It's a good gift, full of potential for blessing, but it's dangerous too. Like handling a live wire, it may electrocute you, derail your life. Both those strands are there, light and dark. Its light side, is it such a blessing from God? Money meets needs. It makes things happen. It enriches life. It's part of God's good, generous provision. And the Bible is full of rich people of faith. Women and men, they supported Jesus financially. He socialized with them, sometimes lavishly. Status and resources were poured into the early church. Reckless generosity is a spiritual gift, an aspect of love itself. And we are called to diligent work, family responsibility, support for the poor, sensible financial planning. Remember Wesley. Earn all you can, give all you can, save all you can. And all of those have implications for our money and our lives. But there's a dark side too. Money is dangerous. Love of it, 1 Timothy 6:10 reminds us, is a root of all kinds of evil. If you have it and depend on it, that's dangerous. If you don't have it and crave it, that's dangerous too. It can control your life and steal your joy and wreck your marriage. And when our hopes, our security, our longings, our deepest convictions about what makes for a good life are wrapped up in it, it's an idol competing with the true God for our worship. Love of money is not an isolated flaw. It's sometimes a penetrating peek into the recesses of a soul's rebellion against God himself. Who of us hasn't fantasized about making money, real money, as we absurdly call it, daydreamt about having it, winning it, earning more of it, been terrified of not having it, planned what to spend it on, seen it as our way forward for our children, our social acceptance, our security, our old age? Who hasn't voted in an election because we've been anxious to protect something or to gain something in this area of money? And when Mammon whispers in our ear, "You need me, you really do, for a good life," and we guiltily mutter back, "I know, I know," then in New Testament terms, we're already candidates for Idolaters Anonymous. Well, in these opening verses of chapter 16 of Luke, Jesus tells us a parable that has tied commentators into knots and puzzled the rest of us for centuries. It leaves us scratching our heads. More scholarly ink has probably been spilt over this parable than any other. For a start, how do you reconcile that familiar gospel line we know so well at the end of verse 13, "You cannot serve God and money, Mammon," with verse 9, where Jesus tells us to use worldly wealth on righteous mammon to gain friends. How does that work? And in verse 8, can it really be right that Jesus appears to be endorsing a commendation of outright dishonesty, congratulating a con man? Well, Jesus is the master storyteller. So many of his parables have a sting in the tail. They're meant to unsettle us. And this isn't the first or last time Jesus took a very crooked man to teach a very straight lesson, a bad man to make a good point. I seem to recall in Luke 18, an unjust judge, perish the thought, used as an analogy to God himself. Well, it's a rabbinical style of argument, lesser to greater. How much more? If an unjust judge will do this, what will God, who is a just judge, do? Here, if a bent, dishonest manager is this shrewd in the use of money he has access to, what will you do with what you have? The story, verse 1, is told to the disciples. This is for us. It's a word to believers. Yes, verse 14, the Pharisees who loved money and thought they knew a thing or two about it are listening in, for they sneer, we're told, at all this. But they're not the primary audience. We are. The parable itself is simple enough. A wealthy man discovers that his trusted steward or business manager has been mishandling his funds, and he promptly sacks him. You're fired. And he makes the mistake of not telling him to clear his desk at once, which gives the manager time to come up with a Baldrick-like cunning plan. There's only a very narrow window of opportunity, verse 2, before he has to hand over the accounts to the boss. And we overhear, verse 3, the conversation in his head, and we're not sure whether to laugh or cry. Being sacked from a job like this was, make no mistake, a potential disaster. Home, income, career, character, and status would all be gone in an instant. And there was no redundancy or benefit safety net. And it gets worse. He's white collar now, verse 3. There's no question of manual work. He's too genteel to dig and too ashamed to beg. He needs a plan. So, verse 4, to ensure his future, which is where he now rapidly needs to focus his entire energy, he calls in his employer's creditors and one by one writes off 20 to 50% of their debts. And these are huge sums. Any listener would have known that. That way, he reasons, they'll really owe him when it matters, and when he needs help. They'll welcome me into their houses, he reasons. Now, the commentators wrestle with whether these are just whopping dishonest discounts, or whether the manager is cleverly waiving his own commission, or whether perhaps he's doing the boss a favor in removing illegal interest charges under the law. We just don't know. He's still, verse 8, a dishonest manager. And what is so baffling, the shocker here, is the employer's reaction to this multi-layered fiddle. Where he should surely have been outraged at being ripped off and demanding prosecution, verse 8, what do we see? He commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. He used the boss's money in the present to secure his future after this job was done with. You've got to hand it to him. I've just read a new biography of Robert Maxwell called Fall. Staggering financial antics he almost pulled off. Feted by presidents and prime ministers, absurdly, it's hard not to feel some grudging admiration for the brass neck of it all. So here. No, of course, Jesus isn't endorsing dishonesty or commending sharp practice, but he is highlighting the shrewdness of refusing to let things simply take their course, of staking everything on a daring course of action and in using economic resources for non-economic goals to secure a good future. And shrewdness, it may surprise you, is a desirable Christian quality. In Matthew 10:16, remember Jesus saying in what may well be the best single sentence comment on this parable, "Be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves." Same word. And that leads Jesus into the ironic aside at the end of verse 8 as he begins to apply all this for us. The people of this world, he says, are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. Well, we know that, don't we? I found myself chuckling at the thought of Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg on our PCC. There might be a few fireworks, mightn't there? These remarkable men get money. They know its power and its reach, how to build a business, get a return, make friends. They're beyond shrewd in that department. Tell me they wouldn't shake up our church finances. Bishop J.C. Ryle's comment seems spot on. The diligence of worldly men about the things of time should put to shame the coldness of professing Christians about the things of eternity. It's as if Jesus says, look, I know you poor, benighted Christians aren't in that league. That's obviously true. But what I'm going to tell you in the next couple of verses about the long-term investment for the future makes these chaps look like a bunch of amateurs. Maybe you're not that shrewd when it comes to the stock market. They've got 80 or 90 years to enjoy what in verse 9 is termed worldly wealth before it's gone. And it's when it's gone, not if, says Jesus. It burns up. It's only for here. It's part of a fallen system. You can't take it with you, as we often say. I want to help you, says Jesus. Help you be a really shrewd investor in something eternal. To put your money where nothing can touch it. And that's the tension of the passage. Here is Jesus naming money as worldly, literally the mammon of unrighteousness, an inherently fallen commodity. And yet, we're to use it to gain friends. Well, what can he mean? Is he being consistent? William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, used to talk about tainted money. But he would then add with a smile, the problem is, taint enough of it. So here's the first of three lessons applying this. I've called it money and our attitude towards others. There's a real connection, Jesus implies, between eternity and time with regard to money. You can't take your money with you, but don't run from it or pussyfoot about with it. Look, you can invest it, says Jesus, in such a way as to enrich your eternity. You can somehow send the fruit of it on ahead by acting now. Seize the moment. You want to know what shrewd looks like? Take your money and make friends, says Jesus. Friends who'll be standing on the edge of glory to welcome you. Friends who'll greet you, love you in your eternal home. Look, someone in the new creation may come up to you and say, I'm here because in 2021 you supported World Mission at All Souls. Or you backed a preaching seminar the Langham Partnership ran. Or you sent that £200 gift to Christianity Explored. Or you gathered me up in a doorway on the Aslan Tea Run. It's exactly the same point Jesus made in Matthew 6:19 when he talked of laying up treasures in heaven. You invest in gospel work, in kingdom enterprises, in the only thing that can last eternally, precious people's lives. And you do that through ministries you know and trust. And when you do that, because of who God is and how his kingdom works, you actually make Jeff Bezos look like an amateur. The really shrewd investor, after the ultimate returns, invests in the lives and salvation of precious people. That's God's total return fund. You can't lose. Isn't this the most exciting motivation for giving? The children earlier thought of the Countess of Huntingdon. I know some of you will have heard of Sir John Lang, who died aged 99 in 1978. He built up the international construction giant of the family name. In his 20s, he vowed that as his personal income increased, his standard of living wouldn't, so he could give more. Later, he transferred 40% of his shareholdings to a Christian foundation, which ploughed many thousands into ministry through the InterVarsity Fellowship, now UCCF, Tyndale House, the London Bible College, Billy Graham's 1954 London Crusade. And when he died, his net estate was £371. And he'd drop into the IVF office in London, always asking the same question. How many students have become Christians this week? He got it. He invested in gospel work. Well, he'll be mobbed in the new creation by friends saying, thank you, John Lang. You helped me with your money. Money and our attitude towards others. Second, money and our attitude towards ourselves. Verses 10 to 12. Here's another sting for us in the story. Life's a bit of a test. Verse 11, money's not actually that huge a thing. The problem is, it becomes a test of our personal faithfulness, our trustworthiness. Because how we handle it often reveals the kind of people we are. It's always a spiritual issue. And that's why the topic can feel so uncomfortable. John Piper has written, the possession of money in this world is a test run for eternity. Can you pass the test of faithfulness with your money? Do you use it as a means of proving the worth of God and the joy you have in supporting his cause? Or does the way you use it prove that what you really enjoy is things, not God? You sometimes hear people say, look, if I had more, I'd give more. No, you wouldn't. It doesn't matter how much you have. You may have a very small amount. If you won the lottery tomorrow, it wouldn't change your heart. The widow who had nothing gave everything. People who have everything sometimes give nothing. It's rarely about circumstances. It's about perspective, about character, and not sums. It's not about how much you have. It's about who you are. It's about priorities, where your heart is. That money we're so preoccupied with, look, I've worked hard for it, you know. It isn't even ours. You don't even own what you think you own. It's all God's. We say week by week in church here, of your own have we given you. More than just words. Our money is someone else's property. Verse 12, it's God's. It's all His. Like the bent manager in the story, we're just stewards. And that changes everything, especially the questions we ask about giving. Rather than how much of my money should I give to God, we learn to ask how much of God's money should I keep for myself. And the difference between the two questions has monumental, eternal implications. Get it wrong, says Jesus, and you may even be cutting into a loss of spiritual blessing. That's what verse 11 calls true riches. As the Puritan Thomas Adams said, to part with what we cannot keep, that we may get what we cannot lose, is a good bargain. Well, money and our attitude to others, we make friends for eternity by shrewd investment in gospel work. Money and our attitude towards ourselves, we make faithful use of the money we have. It's God's, not ours. And finally, money and our attitude to God. How you relate to your money determines whether you're serving God or you're serving money, and you can't serve both. That's impossible. It's there in verse 13. No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money or mammon. Now, this is solemn. It feels almost over the top. And when Jesus uses that Aramaic term for money, he's giving it a personal and spiritual character. Mammon is not some morally neutral means of exchange. It's a rival god, an active agent with a seductive draw, a power out to dominate us. It asks for our allegiance. It makes a bid for our heart. It promises so much and yet delivers so little. It has the power to win us over, to mesmerize us, and even to destroy us. A few years back, I had to sentence a chartered accountant who'd been a lay leader in his church, regional treasurer of his denomination, popular, well-regarded. He defrauded dozens of friends and clients, including his own minister, of over £1.5 million. He'd fallen in love with money, and by definition, out of love with God. I had to give him 8 years. Money derailed his life. Look, we fool ourselves if we think this isn't a Christian problem, our problem. No, according to Jesus, what you feel about money and do with money, whoever you are, can make or break you forever. Because you tend to put your money where your heart is. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer has said, our hearts have room for only one all-embracing devotion. We can only cleave to one Lord. So, as we close these reflections on money, let's take Jesus' teaching to heart. Let's resolve to make some shrewd gospel investment for the future. Christians should be the most generous, enthusiastic, cheerful givers on the planet. And second, let's remember it's all God's anyway. And then let's recognize we're in a real spiritual battle on this subject of money, which is so deep a part of every one of us. And we are given the high calling of using mammon without serving mammon. Let me pray for us as we end. Lord, make us shrewd as serpents, gentle as doves, in this call to use your money in our hands wisely and well. This is a parable of vast, infinite, eternal promise, friends for eternity. Lord, make us part of all that. Motivate us, reconfirm in our hearts that you are the first and the only, Lord of all. Lord of all we are and all we have, now and forever. For your glory. Amen.